Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Work Trends with Megan and Biro. Whether you're here to network, learn, or share, we want you to have fun. During this live broadcast and Twitter chat, we'll discuss the future of work with smart and entertaining guests who value today's business and its impact on the world of work for the future. Stay tuned, because we start in 3, 2, 1.
Good afternoon, everybody. What's happening? I am just back from my very first event, HR Tech Connect, as the co-chair of the event. We were in West Palm Beach, Florida, or Palm Beach Gardens, I should say. It was awesome. And I'm so excited. We'll be doing it again next year. So be on the lookout for more updates about the HR Tech Connect event for me. I got to tell you, I'm back in Cambridge today, and it's cold. We've got winter is right here with us. So we're going to warm you up, though, today. I'm here to warm you up. I want you to feel inspired by today's guest. I want to also give a shout-out to my friend Brian Fonzo for suggesting this as a platform for this gentleman who's with me today. Hey, social connections. Brian and I met months and months, now years ago, right here at Talent Culture. So shout outs to all my friends out there on the socials. Stay good with it. Stay active and stay engaged. So listen, today's Work Trends event is a topic that applies to everyone in the workforce, because at some point in everybody's career, we're going to hit a wall. Now, this is not always a bad thing, right? Because it can make you reevaluate what work is being performed, what level you're performing at in the career direction in which you're going, right? So today we have somebody with us who wrote a book to help us understand how to work our way through our careers and do it with purpose and meaning. I'm going to introduce you to Scott. Scott, how do I pronounce your last name?
Let's go with Mouts. I can go with that. Scott Mouts. That's good.
Scott Mouts. Well, you've just got a little, you heard his voice for the first time. This is very exciting. He is a popular keynote speaker and the author of Find the Fire, Reignite Your Inspiration and Make Work Exciting Again. The anticipated follow-up to Make It Matter, How Managers Can Motivate by Creating Meaning, a book that has received many accolades, including the 2016 Leadership Book of the Year, first runner-up. He's also the CEO of Profound Performance. He's a keynote and training company that helps you work, live, and lead. And live, not just live, but live it in a fulfilled way. So, hey, Scott, welcome.
Hello, everybody, and happy hump day. Glad to be on this show. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
Nice. Man. You're welcome. Tell us just a little bit more about your background and what interests you about this topic.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I'm 24-year. That's 2-4. Don't anybody try to figure out my age either afterwards. I'm a 24-year, I guess, P&G veteran.
You're 24 years old? Is that what you just said?
Yeah, that's what I want the readers to take away. I am 24 years old. I'm like Doogie Howser. I have over two decades of experience at P&G, where I ran some of the okay, insert author trying to be humble now. Where I ran some of the company's biggest multi-billion dollar businesses. And I guess along the way, I did that successfully, which is great and all of that. But I really enjoyed how I built the organizations up along the way. I'm also an adjunct professor at Indiana University. If there's any Hoosiers out there, go IU. I'm an Inc. columnist as well. And as you covered, Megan, I'm an author of a couple of books. And today I'm going to be talking about Find the Fire, Ignite Your Inspiration, and Make Work Exciting Again. I did want to offer up front, before I forget, Megan, for those that are interested in the book, they can find it at scottmouts.com. But I put together for your listeners a free companion workbook for the hashtag WorkTrends crowd for anybody that wants to check it out. It's a pretty cool little tool that allows you to fill in the blank as you go reading the book if you decide that you want to buy it. And we all know what the research says about writing something down versus just trying to read it once and remember it. So really happy to be here. I guess the bottom line is I know what the heck I'm talking about. That's really what you need to take away.
Right. And Scott, what was your role all these years? Please tell the audience just a little bit about where you were living.
Yeah, within Procter & Gamble, it's a very much a brand-driven company. So I spent my career in the brand management function, working my way all the way up the chain until I ran fairly large businesses. And then the job became, you know, kind of part marketing director, part general management. And it gave me just a huge opportunity to have really large organizations in my fold and give me a chance to practice what I'm going to preach today. And it also is what really kind of turned me on to what's been over two decades of a learning journey and me being a research nerd on how folks can reignite their own inspiration at work.
I'm curious, when did you first jump into social media? When did that become real for you as like part of your weekly routine?
You mean as a marketer or just
sure.
in general?
You know what, either as a marketer or just in general.
Yeah, well, I'll touch on both briefly. Obviously, as a marketer, I had to be on kind of the leading edge of understanding social media and how it was going to change the way that consumers buy products. So as soon as, you know, kind of Twitter and Facebook and all those other wonderful tools became a thing, it was part of my job to at least understand how the consumers would interact with it. And then personally, you know, I left Procter & Gamble almost a year ago to pursue full-time my love of speaking and writing and being on great shows like this to broaden my platform for making a difference. And I've had to get up to speed, you know, really quickly on how to use social media for myself to build my own brand and to let people know about what I'm trying to accomplish here with my life.
Well, and I give you a lot of credit, Scott, for just kind of jumping into it because as you and I talked about in the green room, it's not easy building audience. I mean, you know, I've been doing this for 8 years. You have to show up. You have to show up every day, every week. You have to be passionate. You have to stay positive when, you know, there's not everybody out there is going to be your cheerleader, you know, frankly. It's a real mixed bag in social media, right? So
well said.
I give you credit. Welcome. Welcome to the larger community. And, I mean, I'm excited to, you know, share your voice with our audience, share your voice on our blog. So, you know, number one, you're here, so congrats. And number two, you know, talk to us because I know there's so many people out there who wake up every day and they don't feel fulfilled. They don't feel inspired. Why is this such a common problem for so many people here, you know, maybe in this country and maybe beyond globally?
Yeah, super question. You know, first of all, just to put a number to it for your listeners, I wish I could tell you, Megan, that it wasn't at catastrophic levels, this problem of people feeling burned down and uninspired at work. But the truth is, as I like to say in keynotes, you know, 70% of us have lost that love and feeling at work. 70%. And that, you know, maybe by coincidence, maybe not. For those that do, they are able to gain inspiration in their work lives, 70% say that it's almost impossible to keep a grip on it. And it's truly at catastrophic levels. And part of the problem is people assign responsibility for being inspired to somebody else. They assign it externally, especially to their leaders, right? I've interviewed thousands and thousands of people on the art of how you re-inspire oneself at work. And I can't tell you how many people say, well, it starts with my leaders, right? I mean, of course, that's what I want. And research tells us that, in fact, if you were to ask people, what's the one attribute you want more than anything else from your leader, more than anything else, 55% of people will say, and that's a minimum, actually. It ranges up to 65, depending on the study. They will say, I want my leader to be inspirational. And it's like three statistical significant variants above any other attribute you can imagine.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So you follow up with those people. Got it. You want your boss to be inspiring. Are they? Only 11% say yes. And if you're a genius at math, that means 89% of leaders, God bless us, aren't getting the job done. We are not inspiring the troops. And so many people assume, well, gosh, I guess that's just the way things are going to be. That's probably not that surprising for you to hear, but we're not that well equipped as leaders to to inspire the troops. So my first epiphany to your listeners is you got to take it into your own hands. You own the responsibility for re-inspiring yourself at work.
Well, I was just going to say, whose responsibility is it, though, to make people inspired at work, right? Leadership, as you just said, yourself, each person. How do we get from A to B? Like, how do we start instilling that sense of leadership in everybody? Because I truly believe we all are leaders in our own right. I don't care if you're an administrative assistant, an office manager, a project manager, or you're, you know, a V or C level executive. I think we owe it to ourselves every morning to wake up and make a difference. Don't, you know, stop being asleep at the wheel, right? There's so many people that are sleepwalking through their careers. And some people, frankly, are with cultures that they shouldn't be. Or they're not, you know, it's all politics, right? I mean, there's a lot of politics, yeah. Let's be honest, that come in play. I know, you were corporate executive for many years. You get it. Sometimes people are set up to fail in corporations. That's the truth, right?
That is the 100% truth. And to round that out, people far too often believe that, you know, once inspiration is gone, it's gone, that it's a really mysterious force that we don't really have any control over. People believe like, oh, yeah, inspiration. Those are for people that climb the mountains of Tibet and visit monks high up in the peaks.
Right.
You know, it's a mysterious source. And, you know, to be fair, early accounts of inspiration would, you know, kind of lends credence to that. You know, believe it or not, the earliest accounts of inspiration assigned the reason that people got inspired to madness or to the unconscious mind. Or even many accounts used to tie inspiration to the supernatural. Still, other accounts give credit to Lionel Richie. You know, and if that's you, that's fine, Megan. I don't care. He doesn't do it for me though.
Are you? Hey, by the way, Scott, are you dating yourself by bringing up Lionel Richie?
Probably.
Just saying.
I probably have over two decades of work at P&G.
Yeah.
And unless if I started when I was two. The millennial days have left me. So you have this world where people believe that it's mysterious. And I guess here's my goal is to always bring content to the universe that's meaningful and not just, you know, common sense duh. So the first epiphany I want to offer for your listeners today is that, my friends, inspiration is not a mysterious force. That is a misnomer. It is not true. The truth is, inspiration can be codified and coaxed, and you absolutely can create the conditions where inspiration is much more likely to occur in the workplace. And of course, I will, I'll be getting into that more as we talk more.
Cool. So this may seem like a really ridiculous question and it's super obvious, but how important is it for people to feel inspired at work, like in your world?
Yeah, what,
like,
great question.
How does that bake out?
Yeah, history will tell us that it's essential because inspiration stirs us to our greatest accomplishments. It, you know, as I like to say again in keynotes, you know, it's the holy grail of enthusiasm. The power of inspiration extends even beyond that of motivation. And it's probably helpful to discern for just a second the difference between motivation and inspiration to show you just how important this is. So let me explain just very briefly. With motivation is the, you know, who doesn't want that in their life? Who wouldn't want that at work? Motivation is the pragmatic consequence of inspiration. It's that engineer in us that proceeds in a step-by-step fashion until we accomplish our goal. And that's a good thing. Who doesn't want that? But inspiration precedes motivation. It yields moments of galvanizing energy and insight and vision that shoves motivation into action. And this is probably the most important discerning factor. With motivation, we take hold of an idea and we run with it. But with inspiration, an idea takes hold of us. That's what makes it the most powerful force on earth and why it's so important to bring back into your work life.
So I'm a bit of a data nerd these days. I'm an analyst, right? I spend a lot of time, too much time probably, analyzing products, new products in the HR tech space, basically. So if I was to put on my analyst hat right now in this moment, right, how are we going to qualify, identify, and characterize inspiration for those who feel like they need that in order to buy into it?
Great question. Here's the good news. I am a research dork as well, and I'm way deep into research, designing it, developing it. I've hooked up with universities all over the world, and I've hooked up with some of the foremost researchers and inspiration in the world. And what I can tell you with confidence is there are three characteristics to inspiration, three things that conditions that are true for inspiration to truly be inspiration. Number one, something is inspiring. If you could be inspired, something gets evoked by, meaning you could become inspired by an act of bravery, a sunset, a remarkable piece of work. So the first condition is that it's evoked. The second, inspiration can come from within, which makes sense. It's triggered when we gain an awareness of a better possibility or a new interest or a new insight. So you become really jazzed when you learn about an innovative new idea or a new stirring challenge really fires you up. And the third condition is that any of these things can compel us to act. And this may be the most important characteristic, Megan, because plenty of things can inspire us in theory. It's what we do with that inspiration. If we act on it, it truly clears the last bar, and it truly is inspiration. If we let it just lie there, it's really not truly inspiration. So inspiration can be evoked by, it can come from within, or it can compel us to act. But the plot thickens if you want me to continue, because it's not that easy. Just knowing what these characteristics are.
I was just going to say, like, that just sounds too easy for me. Like, what about people who don't feel any of this? Like, they're feeling bummed out, they're depressed, they feel hopeless. Like, what steps can these people take to find inspiration at work or frankly in life? Like, for me, work and life are not separated anymore. It's no longer okay to do that, by the way. Really?
Yeah. Like, it's integrated.
How do we get those people into the fray of, you know, maybe there is something important that I need to wake up for this morning? Maybe I do matter. Maybe there is some hope for me to feel like I'm inspired by my career.
Yes, well said. And the first thing is to understand, if you understand why inspiration is so hard to show up on your doorstep, that's the first step. And here's the problem. I talked about, you know, look, inspiration happens when it's evoked by, it comes from within, or compels us to act. Well, here's the problem. The problem with being evoked by, that's passive by definition. You wait around for it to happen. The problem for with it coming from within is it's very, very elusive. And the problem with compelling us to act is that it can get repressed. So even if you feel that bolt of lightning, it can get repressed, like as you're hinting at, by your toxic work environment or even your own debilitating hangups. So you have the core characteristics of inspiration being passive, elusive, and repressed, which sounds like a teenager's memoir. Not good. So how do you overcome that? The most important thing is to understand we ask ourselves the wrong question when we want to re-inspire ourselves. And research shows that when we realize we're in that moment, we got to pull ourselves out of it. Most of us ask ourselves, well, what inspires me? And then I'm just going to do more of that. And the answer, of course, is as different as the person asking. It can be a sunset, like we said. It could be a great boss, a rare great boss. It could be an act of bravery, whatever. But the problem is when you ask yourself, what inspires me? It's either passive, elusive, or repressed. It's not working. You have to ask yourself a different question. And here's the second epiphany for your listeners. The question is not what inspires me. The question is, how did I lose my inspiration in the first place?
Yeah, I was just going to say that. That's a great question, you know?
It was everywhere when you started, right, Megan? You didn't even have to look for it. It occurred in natural wellsprings everywhere. And so the practice is not to try to create new sources of inspiration out of thin air, but to return to the naturally occurring sources of it and reverse the flow of those so you can tap into them once again. It's less like pushing rocks uphill that way. And so that should probably beg the question, okay, well, great, what drains my inspiration? I'm guessing that's what you want to know next, I would assume.
Well, yeah, don't you think?
I would think so. Well, I don't know. That's the next book. No, of course I know. Yeah, this is what one of the things I've been studying for over two decades. So let me talk now about what causes us to lose our inspiration. You know, what are the forces that drain our inspiration? And this isn't my opinion, Megan. This is the data nerd in me coming out with over two decades of research behind this. And to set this up, I'm going to give you the very, very briefest dip into Greek mythology, where if we enter this, we learn of Zeus and his wife, Mnemosyne, who had nine daughters, nine goddesses, and these nine goddesses presided over the factions of art and sciences. And they're better known by their stage name, the Muses, the Nine Muses. And you may have heard the term before of an artist waiting for his muse to whisper in his ear. You've heard of that before, right?
Absolutely.
You've heard of, you know, the music comes from the idea of muses, as does the idea of the museum, which is a warehouse for all the creative output that the muses inspired. What is fascinating to me is if we assume for a second that there, these nine muses were real in the world, what if we could suspend belief for a minute and say there are actually nine anti-muses in the world as well? They're not goddesses, they're fiends, and they're working to suck the inspiration out of your life one day at a time. And I find it very curious that the data pointed to precisely nine sources of inspiration drains in the world. And these are, again, statistically significant variations above everything else that drives you nuts in your work life. These nine things popped is what drains our inspiration. So with your permission, I'm going to very quickly touch on each one of the nine anti-muses.
Go for it.
The first anti-muse. And then we can dive in on the ones as you want. The first anti-muse, the first way we lose our inspiration at work, whether or not we realize it, and this is almost the antithesis of inspiration, is fear. Fear of failure, fear of criticism, fear of change. The second way, the second anti-muse that drains our inspiration over work, from work over time, whether or not we realize it, is a sense of settling in boredom, operating in a powered down state where you're just not feeling challenged much anymore. So many of us can reach a plateau and just say, I guess work is work. I guess it is what it is. The third anti-muse is inundation. And I often say inundation has become like the new black. It's like in fashion now for people to say how overwhelmed and overwhelmingly busy they are. Well, it's having an impact on our ability to make choices and set priorities. And when we procrastinate or if we're perfectionists, it just adds to it. When we don't know how to push back, it adds to it. Having a loss of control is the fourth anti-muse, where we're operating in a world where we just don't feel like we're having enough of an impact on things that matter. And especially people in ginormous corporations can get swallowed by the whole. You were talking earlier, Megan, about corporate politics. These people that can in particular feel a loss of control in their life.
Big time.
The fifth anti-muse. Yeah, big time.
To me, I mean, not to interrupt, but that's,
yeah, please,
that's huge. Like, I don't think we're there yet where we can say politics don't hold a lot of people back at the workplace. I think they do. I think that's so key. I'm glad you brought it up, you know?
It's a study for
as
a future
this,
day. It's something
yeah.
I'm very interested in. Yes,
no kidding.
You're right.
Yep.
You're right.
Yep.
Okay, so the sixth anti-muse, the sixth way we lose our inspiration, whether or not we realize it, is dwindling self-belief. And I can't tell you how many people raise their hand to this one. And by the one, you know, not every anti-muse is going to apply to every single listener. What listeners usually tell me is there's usually like three of them out of the nine that just hit the bull between the eyes. But dwindling self-belief is one of them where you're operating in a powered down state where you're anything less than a full version of yourself. You're a shell of yourself. And you've turned around and realized, I am not the person I used to be. My confidence has been pummeled down by the system, by my boss, by my lack of belief in myself, by my dwindling self-confidence. The seventh way we lose our inspiration is disconnectedness. And this be, you know, when camaraderie starts to evaporate at work, it can often be just a particularly toxic coworker that is ruining your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're just making you crazy, and we become disconnected from everybody. Seventh way we lose our sense of inspiration at work is a dearth of creating, where we stop creating anything meaningful. Another one is insignificance, where you mentioned this earlier, where all of a sudden you step back and realize how did my work get to the place where it doesn't seem to matter to my company, to any of my coworkers, mm-hmm. and most importantly, it doesn't really seem to matter to me
right.
anymore.
That's
and the final
dangerous.
Answer I
That's
is,
a very
oh,
dangerous place to be.
Super dangerous. And I give a lot of case studies in the book about how you can pull yourself out of that. And the last anti-muse is just utter lack of evocation, where your workplace is so toxic that it's almost impossible to pull yourself out of it. So those are the 9 anti-muses, and we can steer wherever you want.
Love them. Thank you for sharing that, by the way. I guess, you know, my first thought is, if the fear of failure is the opposite of, say, being inspired, right? How do we fight off feelings of failure and remain focused on what got us here in the first place? Because to me, that's so important to take a step back and look at the reality of how you feel about that.
Yeah, great, great question. You know, neuroscience teaches us that our fear of failure, I mean, it literally, it's been shown in MRI scans, it literally shuts down the part of our brain that's most responsible for that portion that's in charge of exploration and risk-taking discovery. So it engages our brain in the wrong conversation. So you have to realize you have the power to reframe the conversation that you have internally on fear of failure. I can give you just a few examples. For example, you know, what if I told you there's really only 3 ways to actually fail? When you quit, when you don't improve, or when you never try. What if I were to remind readers of and listeners of the great Zig Ziglar, who once said, failure is an event, not a person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What if I were to tell
great.
You that failure doesn't
that,
happen to you?
Yeah.
It's one of my
right.
all-time favorites, right? What if I were to tell you that failure doesn't happen to you, it happens for you? Or a couple more. I'm just reframing. What if I were to tell you that you, Megan, don't suffer when you fail? Your ego does. And guess what? You're not the same thing as your ego.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just one last one. This is one of my favorite ones. I still use this one. I remind myself and I reframe fear of failure to say that, wait a minute, my fear of failure isn't there to scare me. It's trying to tell me that something is worth it. Otherwise, I wouldn't feel it.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. That's so cool. I hope all of our listeners out there are inspired, because I know I am. And you and I just met 40 minutes ago, and I am definitely inspired by you and your fire right now. I mean, we're down to a couple minutes left here, and then we're going to take this conversation over to Twitter utilizing the hashtag WorkTrends. If anyone wants to weigh in with how they're feeling about this topic or just how you're feeling in general today. But tell me, we're inundated right now. I talk a lot about digital and transformation and the future of work. There's a lot going on right now for a lot of people. How can people push back on new work requests so their sense of inspiration doesn't dwindle? Because I think this is so important for so many people.
Ah, yes, yes. Oh, gosh, I have so many ways. I'll hit on some of my a couple of my very favorite ones. So how to push back and you know, look good doing it. The first is to remember, you know, to come from a place of accountability. So when your boss asks you to do yet more work, it is entirely legitimate to not take on more work if doing so unfavorably impacts current work. And what happens is requesters of new work, they rarely have visibility, Megan, to the total work that you're doing. So what you do is you visualize your workload on paper and you come from a place of accountability. You push back and say, look, I'd love to take on new project X, but project Y and Z and A and B are going to suffer if I do. You still exude positivity and excitement for the total portfolio of work, but you come from a place of being a respectful realist, not a roadblock, to show that you want me being accountable for my total portfolio of work, right? But if I take this on, that's going to suffer. That's the first way I coach people. Another powerful way is to give a different yes to requests. We've all heard there's a great book called Yes And, I think most people are familiar with that. I talk about no but.
Yeah, right.
You know, we have, most of us, you know why we get more work put on our plate, Megan? Because we don't like to say no. Well, guess what? Technically speaking, you don't have to say no. You just say yes to something different. So, for example, instead of saying yes to that new work request, you can say,
Scott,
well,
we're down, you're not going to believe this. We're down to 10 seconds left, my friend.
Oh.
I want to thank you. We're going to continue this conversation over on Twitter. thank you very much for inspiring us here at Work Trends today and for becoming a new friend. And you keep going because you're onto something. Sound good?
I love it. Thanks for the opportunity. I'll hop over to Twitter.
Okay. Catch you later.